We're going to start the meeting. I don't actually have a gavel yet, but I think we can get going. Oh, there we go. Our schedule for today is this morning before we go into session, we'll just do the side-by-side. We're hoping that doesn't take any more than an hour. And then for members of the audience that would like to testify on any elements of the bill, if you would contact my committee administrator, Mr. Estenson, during the day, then we will reconvene after both bodies adjourn and take public testimony on the bill. And the length of our meeting after session will be determined by the amount of public testimony. We will not reconvene any earlier than 4 p.m. There is a funeral for Ms. Stair, Dick Stair's wife, and many of our friends in transportation would like to attend that funeral. It starts at 2 p.m. in Woodbury, so at the earliest we would reconvene at 4, so you can plan accordingly. Before we get started on the side-by-side, there's some new faces around the table. I thought it might be nice to go around and introduce ourselves. And Mr. Kane, if you want to start on your end, we'll just work our way around. And
I'm Dan Kane, BFL Public Research.
I'm representing the Bernie Leader, Roadmaster.
Representative Wade Seibert, Apple Valley, Burnsville.
Tony Ruth, representing Watsonawa, Pika.
Matt Burris, House Research Analyst.
John Walls, House Business Staff.
Jeremy Estenson, Committee Administrator for Transportation.
Mary Liz Holberg, Lakeville.
Steve Murphy, Red Wing.
Billy Ball, Senate Transportation Committee.
Bonnie Berzovsky, Senate Council.
Chris Boyd, Senate Fiscal Staff.
Bo Burnson, Legislative Assistant for Senator Murphy.
Mike Dungauer, Senate District 48, East Bethel, across Delt River, North Metro.
Terry Bonoff, Senate District 43, Minnetonka, Plymouth, Medicine Lake.
All right, thank you. I think what we'll do now is we'll start, Mr. Burress, we'll start with the side-by-side, and certainly on the Senate-only provisions, if the Senate wants to chime in, and we can go through and see how much of this is the same or similar, and where our major differences are, and that should be able to set us up, hopefully, for a very quick resolution. So this bill, Mr. Burress.
Madam Chair, members, starting on page R3, I think we actually start to get into some of the appropriation money. The both items on page R3 amount to $88 million. It's just supplemental appropriations to MnDOT. On page R4, the first item is bonding for Mankato headquarters. The amounts are the same in both House and Senate. Subdivision 5 is part of the governor's bonding package. That's advanced right-of-way acquisition for additional bonding that the governor has. The final item on page R4 is for renovation of the MnDOT exterior building. The amounts are the same. Page R5, bond sale expenses are just based on the amount of bonding in each bill, so those amounts are different. Same thing with the bond sale authorization. Starting on page 5, but really on page 6, there is the creation of a transit fund. This handles allocations from MVEST, and the differences between the House and Senate are just technical. On page R7 is section 8. This is the transfer of motor vehicle lease revenue to transportation. That continues to page R9. Also on page R9 in section 9, there is a identical change to the constitutional amendment allocating all MVEST revenues to transportation to make it a 60-40 split, a so-called hard 60-40. So 60% goes to highways, 40% to transit. Section 10, also on page R10, is the ballot question that would go to the voters. There is a difference between the House and Senate in question phrasing. On page R11, there is first in section 11 of the House is a ballot placement. This is just provision to designate that the MVEST dedication constitutional question would be first on the ballot coming up in November. Section 12 is just in the House. That is to provide that if there were a court challenge and a court found that the constitutional change that we were just talking about for the hard 60-40 were invalidated by the court, that the ballot question change would still be in effect. Section 13, and by sections, by the way, I'm just going off of the House side for now. Section 13 also deals with the constitutional amendments. This is largely the same between the House and Senate bills, except for one difference. And this provision deals with, if there is a court challenge, how the Supreme Court should handle it. Tries the idea is to create a rapid disposition of the situation or of the question by the court. On page R12, we get into some of the bonding. This starts off with just a summary, so I'll jump to page R13. This is the governor's bonding package. There's $35 million bonded for program delivery, the initial program design and preliminary design elements, and then the actual construction bonding. Page R14 is just in the Senate. I'll pass that off to my colleague.
Madam Chair and members, on the Senate side, the trunk highway bonding is limited to the specified projects and in the specified amounts. There is also a straight trunk highway appropriation that was added on the Senate floor, and that is on R15, Section 3, $100,000 as a grant to the North Metro I-35W Corridor Coalition.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Section 3, also on page R15, again deals with the bond sale expenses that are provided to the Department of Finance for the governor's bonding package. On page R16 is the first provision is only in the House. That again goes to the governor's bonding package. It just creates another account to handle the debt service. Also on page R16, there's an additional provision that's just in the Senate, and that is also updating the transit fund that we had discussed earlier. The final provision that's on page R16 deals with the allocation of revenues to transit, to the transit fund and the highway user tax distribution fund. The actual allocation of revenues is largely the same. The difference between the House and the Senate has to do with the governor's bonding proposal. Again, there's a portion that goes towards that extra account that is created for the MVES collection, and that's for debt service. On page R18, again, there's a bond sale authorization for the governor's bonding package or proposal. Page R19, the first provision prohibits the use or the creation of any new toll roads or toll facilities, and there are exceptions created for the existing MNPAS system and for bridges to other states. Also on page R19, starting on page R19 and extending to the next page, there is a provision that changes the limits for net tax capacity for towns to receive funds from the town road account. There is a difference between the House and the Senate on that as to the amount that's increased of the limit is the same, but in the Senate there is indexing for inflation as well. On page R21, there is a provision that is only in the House, and that is to require that certain contracts that are that reach a threshold amount have to be only awarded to Minnesota-based companies.
And I believe that would be solely applied to the Crosstown project, was the intent.
Yes, that's correct.
All right.
Madam Chair, I would pass it back to my colleague again.
Ms. Berzowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. On the Senate side, on R21, Section 2 is a section that came from the MnDOT land acquisition bill originally. And it provides that during a pending eminent domain action, the court, with the consent of the court, MnDOT can reconvey property to the former owner, whether or not the former owner agrees. But this would be, again, I'm assuming this would be after a quick take, so it would be in the pending eminent domain action should MnDOT determine it did not need that land. Section 3 on page R22, this is part of the Gold Star family plate the Gold Star family license plate program. There are a few sections in Article 3 that deal with this. This is the first one, and it adds a $3 one-time surcharge to sales of all personalized motor vehicle license plates, and the proceeds go to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund and ultimately to fund a benefit that's provided later in the article for these Gold Star families who, I believe, who've lost a member in service. Section 4 on page R24 on the Senate side, it looks like a very small amendment. It amends the law that deals with special plates for veterans to authorize special motorcycle plates for combat wounded veterans. Those plates are currently available for autos, pickup trucks, and recreational vehicles. Section 5 on page R25 amends a special license plate statute that was just enacted in 2005. Instead of disabled American veteran, these plates are available or inscribed for disabled veterans in general. And it goes on to detail how the claim for disability has been awarded and who will design the plate. Section 6 on the Senate side removes vans and pickup trucks from the definition of motor vehicle for the statute that relates to special license plates for disabled veterans. Section 7 on R26 is the main body of the Gold Star Family License Plate Initiative. And that subdivision 1 directs the commissioner to issue a new Gold Star Family License Plate to eligible persons who are designated by the state or the federal Veterans Affairs Department. Subdivision 2 defines eligible person as a surviving spouse, parent, grandparent, sibling, or child of a person who has died during honorable U.S. military service. Subdivision 3 sets the plate fee at $10 and provides that no surcharges may be added, and it exempts a surviving spouse or parent from the fee. Subdivision 4 allows the surviving spouse or parent who has the Gold Star family plate to exempt one vehicle from annual vehicle registration tax. Subdivision 5 directs the Commissioner of Transportation to design the plates in consultation with Veterans Affairs. Subdivision 6 allows application for these plates to be made at any time. And Subdivision 7 allows a transfer of the plates to another vehicle of the eligible person, subject to a $5 fee. Section 8 on the Senate side, R27, requires a motor vehicle dealer to notify the Commissioner of Public Safety electronically of acquisition of an older model vehicle, a late model vehicle, or a high-value vehicle that is titled and registered in Minnesota if the vehicle is to be dismantled or destroyed. The dealer can contract this service to a deputy registrar who can charge a fee of up to $7 per transaction. Madam Chair, I think we're back to...
All right. Thank you. Ms. Horace.
Madam Chair. Section 4 on page R28 on the House side is actually the same as that on the Senate side. Deals with changing how automobile loans that are 7 years old are canceled.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Burstowski.
Madam Chair, Section 10 on R-29 allows the MnDOT Freeway Service Patrol to tow a vehicle in the 8-county metro district if it's located in a hazardous area or it has been involved in an accident. And the language also provides that a tower who has already been requested before MnDOT arrives has the right to finish the job or to be given a reasonable opportunity to complete the service that was requested of it.
Thank you. Mr. Barrett.
Madam Chair, members, Section 5 on page R30 deals with retrieval of contents from a towed vehicle. It allows for people to actually obtain their contents without having to pay the fees to obtain the vehicle, and requires that towers give notice to the registered owner about that. And on page R31, section 6 on the House side, also deals with retrieval of contents.
Ms. Burzowski.
Madam Chair, on section 13, page R31, this changes the definition of motorized foot scooter that was enacted in 2005. And it makes the two requirements, both of the two requirements have to exist in order for a vehicle to constitute a motorized foot scooter. And that is the size of the wheels and the maximum speed.
Thank you. Mr. Barra.
Madam Chair, members, on page R32, section 7 on the House side deals with the definition of a recreational vehicle combination, which is it's a vehicle that is a truck with a fifth wheel coupling that's in turn attached to a trailer or a camper mini trailer, which has a trailer towing another vehicle on it. So it's sort of three vehicles linked together. This adds a golf cart to the types of vehicles that could be on that third trailer. The language is the same between the House and Senate for that provision.
Thank you. Ms. Brzezowski.
Madam Chair, on page R32, section 15, in Senate language, section 15 amends the definition of towing authority in chapter 169 to include the MnDOT Freeway Service Patrol or a private company that's authorized by MnDOT. Section 16 allows the MnDOT Freeway Service Patrol to order a tow off a trunk highway after preparing a written towing report provided by the State Patrol.
Thank you. Mr. Barras.
Page 34, section 9 in the House bill, this allows for requires MnDOT to allow placement of National Guard and other military unit signs on highways entering cities where there is a National Guard armory or a training and community center.
Thank you. Ms. Brzezowski.
So, Madam Chair, member, section 17 on R35 deals with exhibition driving. Under the provisions of that section, vehicle racing is included within the definition of reckless driving, and that is a misdemeanor. A person who operates a vehicle and willfully compares or contests relative speeds is guilty of vehicle racing, even if the vehicle is operated within the speed limit. This provision declares exhibition driving to be a misdemeanor, and that involves starting or accelerating with an unnecessary exhibition of speed, which may be evidenced by tires screeching, throwing sand or gravel, or both. And it specifically excludes authorized emergency vehicles that are responding to an emergency call or pursuing a violator. This section would be effective August 1, 2006 for violations committed on and after that date. Section 18, I believe, has been enacted into law already. Section 19, beginning on R37, is the booster seat provision, and that section adds children between and including the ages of 5 and 8 who weigh less than 80 pounds to the law that requires the use of child passenger restraints in motor vehicles. And there are some other specific provisions and requirements in there requiring a rear-facing child restraint for a child less than 1 year weighing under 20 pounds, for a child who weighs 80 pounds or more under the age of 9 to be restrained in a seatbelt. A child under the age of 9 must sit in the back seat, subject to certain exceptions. And a child under the age of 9 who weighs 40 pounds or more may wear a lap-only seatbelt in the rear if there are no shoulder belts in the back or if they're all in use. This section also requires an operator of a pickup truck or sports utility vehicle who is transporting a child under the age of 9 to transport the child within the vehicle's passenger compartment. The fine for a first violation of these provisions may be waived or reduced if the driver shows evidence of having acquired a booster seat. And also, an officer who issues a citation for violation must provide written information to the driver concerning the availability of no-cost child restraint equipment for people in need. I guess we'll go on from there. Section 20 is the primary seatbelt, one of the primary seatbelt sections. It changes the seatbelt law to apply the current requirement to wear a seatbelt to all passengers in a passenger vehicle, and allows primary enforcement of the seatbelt law.
Thank you, Mr. Burek.
Madam Chair, members, on page R39, section 8 in the House language, this again deals with the recreational vehicle combination, just adds, again, motorized golf carts. There is a difference between the House and Senate language. In the Senate, there is a deletion of an overall or a middle vehicle length limit. And then on page R40, section 10, this amends restrictions on the gross weight of pneumatic tired vehicles. It raises the gross weight limit on any wheel to 10,000 pounds and also raises the limit on any single axle to 20,000 pounds. On page R41, this is based on using a table of weights and axle distances. It allows trucks with certain weights to operate on routes that have a maximum weight limit of 9 tons per axle. The actual change is on page R47, and the difference between the House and Senate is just technical. Also on page R47, section 12 of the House language, there is an amendment to the gross vehicle weight limit of all axles of a vehicle so that it's 80,000 pounds for any vehicle on all trunk highways and routes that have a maximum weight limit of 9 tons per axle. It's also changed to be 73,280 pounds for any vehicle with 5 axles or less, and that's for all routes that are not trunk highways, designated routes for routes that have a maximum weight limit of 9 tons per axle. On page R49, section 13 of the House language, this changes towing provisions of when tow companies can do tows. The difference between the House and Senate is, non-existent, there isn't a difference. Also, section 14 of the House language, section 24 of the Senate language, there's also a towing provision, and there's no difference between the two. Section 15 of the House language is dealing with seasonal load restrictions, and that just increases the restriction from 5 to 7 tons per single axle.
Mr. Zowski, I'm sorry.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. On R50, section 25, this was a floor amendment in the Senate. It removes the prohibition that currently would prevent a financial institution with a security interest in a forfeited vehicle that was forfeited in an offense related to DWI from selling that vehicle back to a member of the violator's household. Section 26 adds to the definition of conviction in the driver's license law that a plea of nolo contendere or no contest that is accepted by the court is the same as a conviction for purposes of driver's license law. Section 27 on R51, this just conforms existing instruction permit language to the primary seatbelt section. Section 28 on R52 also conforms language relating this time to provisional license holders to the primary seatbelt section. And the section also incorporates two new graduated licensing prohibitions on provisional license holders under 18 years of age in their first year of licensure. One is that a provisional license holder cannot drive with more than one passenger under age 21, except for immediate family members. And the other is the imposition of a curfew, midnight to 5 a.m., unless the driver is accompanied by a parent or guardian. Section 29 adds to the, on page R53, adds to the required content of a driver's license, the license class, and any endorsements or restrictions. Section 30 has been enacted. Section 31 on page R55 requires the cancellation of the driver's license of a person who failed to give correct information on a driver's license application and committed fraud or deceit in making the application. The cancellation has to last for the longer of 60 days or until the required information is provided. Section 32 on page R55 allows suspension of a driver's license if the licensee pays or tries to pay vehicle taxes or fees with a dishonored check. And section 33 on R57 allows an advertising device to be erected adjacent to a road with the consent of the landowner or lessee. And if the sign does not exceed 432 square inches, it has to show the owner's name and contact information and be displayed for no more than 6 weeks out of a calendar year.
Thank you. Mr. Barrett.
Madam Chair, members, Section 16 on page R57 deals with area transportation partnerships, and it prevents any MnDOT or other state agency staff from being voting members on the ATPs. Page R58, Section 17, this requires an annual report by MnDOT on major highway projects, which and it establishes a cost floor for what would be classified as a major highway project and lays out some of the details of the contents of the report. This was discussed in committee and was a floor amendment. Page R59, Section 18, this provision is a change to the Mercy program for the rail accounts, and it allows for grants of up to 40% of the cost on a rail line. Well, there are a couple pieces of that. I guess I won't go into the detail until later, but it changes the grant allowance and requirements. Section 19 on page R59 also goes to that program by allowing rehabilitation of rail under that grant. Page R60, Section 20. This was is a change to the amount of gasoline that is fuel usage that's apportioned to ATV use. So it changes the percentage apportionment.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and members, the next three sections, beginning on R60, sections 34, 35, and 36 are the anti-gasoline price gouging provisions. I'm going to start with section 36 because that explains what the prohibition involves. Section 36 prohibits gasoline sales at grossly excessive prices, and it further provides that a retailer or jobber wholesaler may not charge a price that grossly exceeds the gasoline cost to that retailer or jobber wholesaler. and a refiner may not charge a price that grossly exceeds the average gasoline price sold by that refiner in the preceding 21 days. There is no definition of grossly exceeds in the bill, but later on there is a provision that directs the Commissioner of Commerce to adopt expedited rules to define that term. In sections 34 and 35 that are just before this prohibition, make available misdemeanor penalties and injunctive relief that to punish or restrain violations of the Section 36 sale prohibition. Section 37 on R62 provides that the operation and maintenance of airports is an essential public service. Section 38 on R63 makes the municipality ineligible for assistance from the State Airports Fund if it adopts a comprehensive plan that the commissioner finds incompatible with the state aviation plan. And Section 39 on R64 requires a seller of real estate that's located in safety zone A, B, or C of an airport to disclose to the buyer the existence of airport zoning regulations that affect the property. And this disclosure must take place before the seller can accept consideration or sign an agreement of sale.
Thank you. Mr. Barrett.
Madam Chair, members, on page R64, section 21, this just delays the required date for designation of a International Economic Development Zone from June 30th of 2006 to June 30th of 2008. It also delays the start of the duration of the zone by 3 years. So that would be the calendar year 2010. Section 22 on page R65 also relates to the International Economic Development Zone. It just requires copies of the business plan to be provided to the legislature. On page R66, section 23 of the House language, this allows for town roads to do a piggyback on contracts for construction with counties. The language is the same between the House and Senate.
I'm sorry, Ms. Bersowski.
Madam Chair, members, on page R66, Section 41 requires the Metropolitan Council to ensure that the geographic service area for Metro Mobility Special Transportation Service is continuous within the transit taxing district boundaries as they exist as of March 1, 2006. Section 42 on page R68 has been enacted.
Thank you, Mr. Barra.
Madam Chair, members, Section 24 of the House language on page R68 allows for MnDOT to contract with an adjoining state for construction of Trunk Highway 60. Section 25, also on page R68, is a requirement of a study for MnDOT to examine long-range transportation solutions. It lays out some of the requirements for the study. The language is the same between the House and Senate. On page R69, there is a report requirement. This is section 26 of the House language. This requirement is an annual report that examines the difference in costing amounts or comparison of costing amounts between public and private contractors and how much work is associated with each. The language is the same between the House and Senate.
Madam Chair and members, Zelsky. Section 43 on R70, this goes along with the booster seat provision. It directs the Commissioner of Public Safety to conduct a child passenger restraint law awareness campaign to educate the public about state laws on child passenger restraint and to let people in financial need know how to obtain these restraint systems at no cost. Section 44 on R70 directs the Commissioner of Transportation to erect a specific service sign on Trunk Highway 52 in Olmsted County that displays the name or business panel of a retail establishment on Trunk Highway 52. Section 48. Okay, the other ones were earlier, I guess. Yeah, Section 48 on R70 requires the Commissioner of Transportation to study public transportation needs in greater Minnesota and report no later than February 15, 2007. Section 49 on R71 has been enacted. And Section 50 on R71, I alluded to earlier, and this is the direction to the Commissioner of Commerce to adopt rules to define grossly exceeds and other terms in the sections relating to gasoline price, sales of gasoline at grossly excessive prices.
Okay, thank you. I see we just have some repealers.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, the repealers deal with the toll road prohibition. That was a House floor amendment that we discussed earlier.
All right, thank you. Mr. Walls, would you like to go through the spreadsheet at this time?
Tan-colored spreadsheet. Many of these provisions have been discussed before in the walkthrough, so I will try to go through them very quickly. Madam Chair, you can see that the House includes the Governor's request for $88 million in additional dollars to be spent for road construction. The Senate does not include that provision. Both sides include $18.2 million for construction of the Mankato headquarters. The House includes $15 million in fiscal 07 for advanced right-of-way purchase as part of the governor's $2.5 billion bonding proposal. The Senate does not. The Senate includes earmarks of trunk highway bond dollars for a few different projects, one of them being Trunk Highway 610, an interchange with 169 for $6 million. Trunk Highway 61, appropriation of $300,000, $150,000 for the French Rapids Bridge, and as mentioned previously, a Senate floor amendment for $100,000. I believe that's Trunk Highway Fund. Madam Chair, I'm not clear on that. Perhaps Krista Boyd could answer that question. An appropriation for the I-35 Corridor Coalition.
The I-35. The I-35W Corridor Coalition is direct appropriation from Trunk Highway Fund. It's not bonding balance.
And if I might, then does that contribute to the $350 on the bond sale expenses in the Senate?
The I-35? No. It doesn't contribute to that.
And so, okay, and if so, that the line where you have the 350 in the
right.
Senate and the House has 41,
right.
Given the difference in bonding, I'm just wondering why the
amount
is so much higher for the Senate as
right.
opposed to the House.
Madam Chair, it's traditional that one includes 0.1% for bond sale expenses, or it's a 1/100th, 0.1%, and I believe the Senate would just need to move the decimal point over. I think it was an oversight. I believe it should be 35. I believe it should be 35,000.
Madam Chair, we'll have to check on that. According to our capital investment fiscal analyst, we use 1%, but we can certainly try to reconcile this between us.
Okay, I find it curious that the House has so much more bonding in its bill, but the expenses are far less. There must be something there that I'm not understanding. Mr. Walls.
Madam Chair, moving along, on the Department of Public Safety, neither side chose to include the governor's request for facial recognition technology to the Department of Public Safety, but both sides do include $10 million for the DOT exterior. Again, we have the bond sale expenses as we discussed earlier. Neither side included the Mounds View reimbursement as requested by the governor, the motor vehicle transfer fee correction, The House has a revenue item for a provision changing the deposit of sales tax on vehicle leases going from the general sales tax to motor vehicle sales tax. That item would occur in the next biennium and would be an additional $25 million a year to the highway user tax distribution fund to be split between counties, cities, and the state, as well as additional money for Metro Transit and Greater Minnesota Transit. This new revenue would be split based on the 60-40 provision that both sides have included in their bills. Madam Chair, there's also an ATV fund increase that was mentioned earlier, changing the amount of gas tax collected that's attributed to ATVs. This provides an additional $630,000 to the ATV account and is a loss to the highway user account. The House includes this provision. The Senate does not. The Senate has several revenue provisions for the Gold Star family plates, raising $3,000 a year, I believe, due to the I believe there's a special $10 fee. And Madam Chair, there's $36,000 in revenue raised from the $3 surcharge, but a loss of revenue to the highway user tax distribution account because it creates an exemption for renewal of those plates. And Madam Chair, in addition, the House includes the $2.5 million bonding proposal. It's not exactly laid out in law how that would be issued. However, it's assumed that the authorizations would be around $250 million a year for 10 years, but that the amounts and the years that they are authorized in is at the discretion of the Commissioner of Transportation.
Right, thank you. Members, are there any questions at this time on the side? We'll reconvene later today to take testimony and get into items that members have concerns or questions about. Are there any general questions at this time? If not, I would suggest if there's particular issues that you want individuals to testify on for or against, that you get that information to Senator Murphy or myself during the day. And again, we will not reconvene any earlier than 4 p.m. in order that people may attend the funeral this afternoon. And so at this time, we'll be in recess to the call of the chair. Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill Committee hearing. We had a number of people contact us saying they'd like to testify on various elements of the bills in consideration, and also a number of people that said they'd be standby for phone a friend, and we appreciate that as well. The first item we are going to discuss is the 10-ton road seasonal load restriction modifications. I have Kent Sulem, Rob Vanosik, Carol Lovero, and Ann Finn on behalf of the local units of government. Are any of them in the room? All right. Fred Corrigan, is he in the room? I'm sorry, Ms. Finn. If you'd step to the table and provide testimony, we'd appreciate it. And members, that provision's on R40 of the side-by-side. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and we are here this evening to express our concern about the road restrictions provisions in the bill, in the House position, I should say. And we, I'm here with our expert, so I'll let him do more of the talking, but I'm here just as a representative of the League to offer that we do have the same concern.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, I'm Dennis Berg, Hinokie County Commissioner. I'm chair of the County Public Works Committee, and I was also on the Truck Size and Weight Advisory Committee. And it is really the concerns, and I think what we'll do is let Carol Lovero see. As you can see, we're getting organized here, too. she just joined us, but Carol is also with AMC, so.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Loverall. Just state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Carol Loverall with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And we are concerned about a couple provisions in the bill relating to weight limits. The first provision deals with raising the single axle weight from 18,000 pounds to 20,000 pounds, which in effect would declare all county, city, township roads 10 tons. And there's a couple of problems with that. One, Commissioner Berg will elaborate on. If you declare a 10-ton standard, what does that do to the needs in the county state aid highway formula? And MnDOT has not been able to clarify that for us. So that's a question. The other question revolves around costs. And at the current time, county state aid highways contain 30,000 miles. And from the state aid office, we've established that there's 2,000 designated 10-ton roads and maybe another 2,000 to 3,000 that may be 10-ton roads that aren't declared. And we're in the process of doing a structural analysis, a strength test, to determine what all the county state aid highways tonnage is. But estimated cost, if you take the 25,000 miles that are left, we would have to post those roads at a 9-ton standard if they're declared 10-ton. And it's $100 a sign, so the estimated cost is over $1 million. So we have concerns about that. The county engineers participated also in the MnDOT truck weight limit study, and there's a lot of controversy within that association as well as our own. So at one of the ledge steering committees, we laid this issue on the table with the commitment to work with MnDOT over the interim, investigate these issues further so that we can come back next year with a proposal. And so then I'll turn it over to Commissioner Berg again to talk more about his concerns about the needs.
Thank you. Commissioner Berg.
And in particular, it's on page 40, section 10, 1 and 2, where we go from the 9-ton to the 10-ton standard. And I think I'd like to start it out by saying that even among counties, there's not what you'd call agreement. I think we all would like to have all our roads 10-ton. There's a huge economic benefit. There's a lot of other benefits. But the reality of it is, there's a lot of roads out there that just will, you know, we're just going to lose them. They're going to lose their useful life if we don't protect them to the standards that they're actually more capable of carrying. I think Carol mentioned the needs. And a little bit of background. In the county highway funding formula, the CASA formula that gets a lot of attention, the way the money is divided up between counties, that 29% of the highway trust fund, the formula is 10% vehicles, 10% to every county to cover the cost of having a county engineer, 30% registered vehicles, but 50% of that formula is what they call needs. And by definition, the needs are what it will take to bring the roads up to the state aid standards. The state aid standard is 9-ton. At least there are some roads out there that there's language in there that it's 7-ton with the capacity to go to 9-ton. But when we start going automatically just saying, well, now we're going to declare everything 10-ton, that's going to change the needs, because now we go back and look at, well, this particular county road, if when we do rebuild that road, instead of costing X amount of dollars, we're going to have to build it to a higher structural strength, it's going to cost more. And it gets to be a controversial issue, even though our goal is that we'd like to see all our roads at 10-ton, but to build a 10-ton road in the metro area, for example, where we've got 1,500 trucks a day, as compared to a rural area where they may have 1,500 trucks a year, we have to build to a much higher standard. If you kind of picture a blacktop road with truck traffic on it, it looks like a piece of wire, and when you get past that structural strength, see a road that 10 tons starts to flex when a truck goes over. One truck, you're not going to notice it. It's like having a piece of wire and bending it once each time a truck goes over. And you've got one or two trucks a day, you know, the road will probably last its useful life from other deterioration in addition to the truck weight. But you start bending that piece of wire 1,500 times a day, in a year's time, it breaks. And that's, in a sense, kind of what happens to the roads. Now, as road authorities, You know, we want to get as many roads on a 10-ton system as possible. We've started developing a map through AMC of all the county roads. And in the past, when you built a road, you know, the engineering standards were really based on what type of soil. You know, if you had a lot of muck, you dug it out, replaced it with a good base. And a lot of times you have to truck in the base soil to achieve the standard we want, the amount of compaction, the amount of blacktop to get to a 9-ton standard. The reality of it is, we have roads out there, we know that, that were built to engineering standards for 9-ton, but because of the opportunity of a better quality base soil, maybe can also support a 10-ton equally well. So this past year, the county commissioners and the county engineers supported taking money out of the administrative account to the county state aid highway fund. And actually, MnDOT is starting within the next couple of weeks to going out and testing roads that we've selected, and it'll be a huge percentage of the roads, where they're actually testing them for the deflection factor. So we'll at least know which roads are going to deflect that are now 9-ton and even some 7-ton roads. That, the results of that won't be back till this fall. But the other big factor that we really don't have a way of identifying yet is simply to know how many trucks are on the road and how heavy they are. We can tell you how many vehicles are on the road, but it's kind of hard to hire a traffic counter to sit at the intersection and count trucks and say this truck was 7-ton, this ton was 6-ton. So we need to get a way to really identify what the truck traffic is. But the long and the short, I think we all share the same goal, but we have a lot of issues that we really need to get resolved so we don't create a bigger problem. You know, we don't want to destroy roads that could be preserved in an anxious attempt to get to 10-ton, and we don't want to be posting roads at 9-ton when, in fact, they could be 10. So we're not asking this to get killed, but we do ask for time to get a handle on this and get some agreement to so we know what all the issues are. There are other issues. The 5 to 10, I think, we'll let the League of Cities address. But we would like to have more dialogue, and we would really like to have this study come back that we have commissioned, which is in progress, so we do know a little bit more about what we really have, what our base is, and then move forward.
Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Loveroe, Ms. Finn, did you want to speak to the seasonal weight restriction issue?
Madam Chair, members, actually, I have with me a letter that I would like distributed to the committee that was put together by the Legislative Committee of the City Engineers Association of Minnesota, and it better articulates their concerns than I could for you. So I will distribute that. They are very concerned about the 5-ton to 7-ton change for the same reasons as many of the same reasons that the counties are concerned about the 10-ton standard, much of which is the posting costs for posting the roads and just not having the opportunity to maybe analyze the impact of this legislation in advance.
All right, thank you. Members, are there any questions for these testifiers? Senator John Brower.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick question for Commissioner Berg. When, as you talked about identifying how much traffic, when MnDOT Commercial Vehicle Enforcement works a specific area like in our district, Viking Boulevard and Nowland Boulevard, do they keep track of the amount of commercial vehicles that move through there on a daily basis?
They do.
Madam
Chair and Senator John Brower, they do, and that's one of the ways we can tell, but it's a big state and it's very limited enforcement opportunity. So, you know, while that will help us in Anoka County for the intersection of 5 and 24, which is a county state aid intersection, we have a lot of intersections that we don't have, you know, as much data. And there, too, it's only the trucks that they've weighed, but it does, you know, I mean, you can kind of, you know, you've seen 100 trucks and 5 of them were 9-ton and the rest weren't, you know, you can come up with some idea. We're never going to have an accurate account, but we need to know the difference between 100 and 500 a day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, have heard from the city engineer in Minnetonka represented, and so I'm wondering if it might be possible to hear from MnDOT to find out what they might think of how the changes would affect the roads, just to get a sense of if they, in fact, concur. Would that be possible?
Certainly.
Is there somebody here from MnDOT?
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Parker. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. The department does have a position on this section, and we agree with the local governments. that this should not be in this bill, and it is not because we don't think this is a good idea. We, in fact, proposed it in our truck study that we had last summer. And at some point during the course of the study, we took it out because of the local opposition, because we had made a pledge to the local units of government that we would work with them and that we would not push them beyond where they were comfortable going. But it was also our understanding that if we had another year or so of discussion on this and the department completed its study, that the counties anticipated, as Commissioner Berg said, that they would be moving forward on this issue, because the counties themselves are not all of one mind on this issue, and there are some that are ready for this and some that are not. But the difficulty is that if some are ready and some are not, and you have roads posted in many counties, then you have a patchwork system just like you have today. Just enacting this does not create the seamless system that people desire. And the study that was referred to, half of it was done last year. I talked to our pavement engineer who's in charge of it today, and half of it, actually it's a quarter of all the county state aid roads were looked at last year. A quarter will be looked at this summer. And from that look at half of all the CASA roads, they will extrapolate a lot of data about how to manage the system in the future. So we were really hoping that we could have this discussion in the context of MnDOT's truck weight study with our local partners and have a lot more discussion about it and then proceed in a more comprehensive and thoughtful fashion.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions for Ms. Parker while she's here? Representative Rue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Parker, I'm just wondering, I understand all of what you're saying, and I'm just curious, though, how much difference do you think this would really make? Is it We're hearing also that the trucks are driving on the roads, and so I'm wondering, do you really feel that this would have increased traffic flow if this went through?
Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, Representative Ruth, I don't mean to be cynical about this, but to some extent, to a large extent, the compliance with the existing law depends on enforcement, and MnDOT and the State Patrol have done two studies on truck enforcement, one on safety and one specifically on weight enforcement, within the past 18 months. And the department is now in the process of implementing additional weight enforcement, because we've recognized that in order to preserve the infrastructure we've got, we need to have better enforcement than we've had so far. So we are committed with the State Patrol to increasing enforcement. And so I guess we're not ready to give up on managing the system as it exists and trying to get more out of it through better enforcement.
Commissioner Berg?
If I could also address part of the concerns that a lot of the engineers have in trying to preserve their base road. It's the total number of trucks that make the difference, the amount of flexing that the road has to endure. But right now, if we have a 9-ton corridor, that would actually be a shortcut for a destination for a truck that's hauling 10-ton, but there's also a state route that's probably 2-3 miles out of his travel shed. He's driving the state route. But if this road gets posted at 10-ton, it's going to pick up a lot more traffic. So we really don't know. You know, we want to make sure the road then that's going to 10-ton is, in fact, going to be able to withstand that. Because once you post everything, the whole travel shed is going to change in the truck industry. We all take the shortest route possible. And a lot of times that will shift from a trunk highway to a county state aid highway or a county road.
Thank you, Commissioner Berg. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Ms. Parker, in the county state aid highway system, where you have your annual needs report and runs, I think there is a situation where it shows a total cost to upgrade to 10-ton or total system. Would you have that number? As far as, I'm not talking about posting costs, I'm talking about to upgrade them to 10-ton from their 9-ton.
Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, Representative Leader, I don't have that information with me. It was my understanding from things that Rick Jonas told me, he's our assistant state aid engineer, during the course of our truck weight study, that we did not have all of that information yet, and one of the things they were doing was trying to collect it. But Commissioner Berg may correct me on that.
Commissioner
Berg.
I've actually got the book with me. It's kind of a Bible for those of us that have to deal with that. but I don't recall seeing a total in the book, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was a total somewhere for 10 ton. The book does show the total to bring it to a 9-ton standard, which, you know, in reality, the 9-ton standard that we're trying to move away from has been around since 1958. We didn't have 18-wheelers on our roads in 1958, and we're still building to that standard. So, I mean, the logic is we're on the right track. We need to go to 10 and probably heavier. But we just got to be careful that we don't pay too high a price in getting there.
Are there any additional questions? Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along that same line, Commissioner Berg, if you have the total cost upgrade to 9-ton, do you have that handy? Because that's a significant cost, and if you're upgrading one more ton, it at least gives the committee an idea what the total cost is. And I think I wouldn't want to guess, but even what your total lease costs are for 2006.
Well, the annual lease is 300. Excuse me, Madam Chair. $327 million is the adjusted annual state aid money needs, and that's just on the state aid system. But I think the number you're looking for is what it would take to the total price. And I'm going to have to go through and look for it to come up with
it. While you're doing that, Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe it's irrelevant, but really that we shouldn't spend the time on that. But it's a significant cost, and if they'd have it, I think the committee would be surprised at the total cost it would take.
Or maybe we wouldn't be. Thank you. Mr. Vanasek, if you'd like to briefly add your comments before we go on to the next issue, that would be great.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Rob Vanasek. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Towns and Townships. Thank you for the opportunity to testify tonight. I had a handout passed out that's on behalf of Minnesota Association of Townships, the League of Cities, Association of Minnesota Counties, and Metropolitan Intercounty Association, as well as the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. I'll just let that sum up our remarks, but add we expect to work with MnDOT and the counties and other stakeholders on this issue this summer. It was our understanding that this issue was not going to come up this session. We were surprised that it was added a couple of days ago on the floor, but hopefully we can address this a little more comprehensively in the future. Thank you.
Are there any additional questions for Mr. Vanasek? All right, thank you, gentlemen. The next issue on my list of people that would like to testify is the primary seat belts and other traffic safety provisions. Ms. Weinholzer from AAA and Ms. Cooper. If there's anybody in the audience that would like to testify that they did not contact Mr. Estenson, if you'd give a note to the page Stephen here, let us know. We'd like that information as well so we can use the appropriate amount of time this evening and get everybody in. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gail Weinholzer. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for AAA Minnesota, Iowa. I appreciate the time tonight. I know you're as interested in traffic safety as AAA is. We've been working at it for more than 100 years, and we have a couple of issues that are of particular interest to this legislative session. Obviously, the first, although not necessarily in order of importance, but the first handout you should have received was on child passenger safety. Our membership is overwhelmingly in support of this issue. 87% actually want a law that mandates children under the age of 8 be in an appropriate child restraint system. Now, you have the handouts. I'm sure most of you have seen them before. I just want to hit on a couple of key issues that came up during the House floor session this week. One was some concerns about the cost of booster seats and how they might be available to low-income folks. And I want to address that in just a couple of ways. One is that if the bill is approved, if the age is approved through the Safety Lou reauthorization, Minnesota is eligible to receive $350,000 for low-income families to use to purchase booster seats. I should also mention that county departments of health provide them free of charge, as does AAA, the Minnesota Safety Council, and those and similar groups. So there shouldn't be a concern, although I should also add that the average booster seat at Walmart or Target right now is about $15. So while it's not a big financial constraint, I do understand for some low-income families it is, and therefore we make it available. In fact, we're having a car seat clinic at AAA in Burnsville this Saturday, and recently, in the last couple of days, I was out making purchases of car seats and booster seats that I know we'll be giving away. I did want to address that concern that was expressed on the House floor. The other concern that was expressed on the House floor by Representative Walker, I want to make sure I clarify, and that is this bill's language does not mandate a booster seat. I use that phrase a lot. Others use that phrase a lot. It really doesn't mandate a booster seat because I know Representative Walker was concerned about larger children being, you know, forced into smaller booster seats. What this bill says is that children must be in appropriate child passenger restraint. So if they're small and they're in a car seat, if they're medium-sized, that would be a booster seat. And if they're a large child, as Representative Walker indicated on the House floor, that she had a boy that grew rather quickly, that obviously would not fit in a booster seat. An adjustable car seat that a lot of vehicles have right now would fully meet that, despite the fact it gets called a booster seat bill, does not mandate a booster seat. The second issue is the graduated driver's licensing law. I know that's received a lot of publicity in the last few weeks. There's an editorial in the Star Tribune that's attached to the handout. There were some concerns in the House in regards to carpooling, parental rights, and double dating. I just wanted to address those quickly. We are not banning double dating in the state of Minnesota. I promise you we are not banning double dating. What we're saying is that the provisional driver shouldn't be the person behind the wheel. So if there's a 15 and a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old dating an 18-year-old, as teenagers frequently do, so long as the person driving does not have the provisional license, it's perfectly fine. Secondly, I know there's a great deal of concern about parental rights, and I'm very sensitive to that issue. But I just call your attention to the chart that shows the 2/3 of the deaths involving teenage drivers are not the teenage driver. I mean, it would be terrible enough, and I think you can make the parental rights argument very strongly. It would be terrible enough if teen drivers were only killing themselves. But 2/3 of the people they're killing are not themselves. And that's why we think it's a societal issue. And if you'll notice the chart, Minnesota is only one of 5 states that doesn't have these 2 provisions. Obviously, 45 states don't see it as being too onerous, haven't had a great deal of pushback on parental rights. And I think what we're doing is just acknowledging that teenagers need a little bit more practice behind the wheel so they can judge speed and distance at night and so they cannot be distracted by a bunch of teens in the car. And it's unfortunate because we've had a lot of profile accidents in the last few weeks, and I hate the fact that we have, but I think it does bring some attention to the issue that you put a lot of teens in a car and you're really increasing the chance that there's going to be an accident. And regrettably, because those are the folks who don't wear the seatbelts, it's also going to be the ones that are fatal. Not all crashes are survivable, but certainly statistics show approximately 50% of those people killed without a seatbelt probably would have lived if they had it on. And we all know teens feel that invincibility. And that segues into the third issue, and that's the primary enforcement of the seatbelt. Again, I know it's a concern of individual rights. I understand that and I respect that. But I think the codes data that the Department of Public Safety has put together clearly shows it's a societal issue when it comes to all of us paying our insurance premiums, hospital costs, all those sorts of things. And again, there's just an amazingly high correlation between teen and young adults not wearing a seatbelt and being in car crashes that don't need to be fatal. So I would draw your attention to the letter from the Minnesota Safety Council. We work closely with them, and they care deeply about that issue as well. So I'd like to close by encouraging you, beseeching you, pleading with you, whatever I need to do. These are 3 traffic safety laws that can save a lot of lives and not cost the taxpayers any money. And I think I know, certainly a concern of the legislature. We don't want to put a financial constraint on state government, but we do want to save lives. We know public safety is important to all of you. You know that traffic safety and traffic crashes are the leading cause of death under the age of 34. And I hope you will consider these provisions. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Cooper. Welcome to the committee. So state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Catherine Cooper. I'm from a mom from Northfield, Minnesota, previously of Kenyon. And I'm here tonight to ask the committee to upgrade Minnesota's seatbelt law. I have testified before many of you in the past 6 years, so some of you do know my story. I hope that you will have patience while I briefly tell the story of my daughter, Megan. Megan was just 15 years old when she was killed by a drunk driver. It was the last day of school. She was a passenger in the back seat of a car. And when the car crashed, she was ejected out the rear window. She died of severe brain trauma 2 days later. She was not buckled. Megan was not drinking herself that day. She did not get into the car with a drunk driver. She did not cause the crash. She did not break any laws. But she made a decision that day that cost her her life. And I believe in my heart that she made that decision based on Minnesota law. This bill isn't about Megan. It won't bring her back. But then again, it is, because she gave her life that others might live. You see, I brought both my girls home from HCMC in car seats, and I raised them in seat belts. And we always buckled up as a family. Every time, all of us, each one of us, mom and dad and both girls, everywhere we went. We buckled up her classmates. We buckled up the Kenyon girls basketball team. We buckled up the 4-H club. We always buckled up. So what happened? I had to dig deep into my soul after Megan died, trying to remember, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? I taught her to wear a seatbelt. Why wasn't she buckled? And then I remembered the day that I took her to Rochester, right before prom, and she challenged me. As I pulled out onto Highway 56, I noticed she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. And I asked her to put it on, and she said, "No, Mom." And I pulled off the highway and said, "I'm not taking you, Megan, until you put your seatbelt on. What is the deal here?" And she said, "Mom, you are so stupid. It's not even the law." Well, of course, I didn't know what she was talking about because, as I said, we had always buckled up. I really didn't know what the law was myself. We buckled up. And so she put her seatbelt on, and away we went. But 3 weeks later, Megan was dead. I was to later learn that she learned that piece of information mostly in driver's ed, when she learned about the traffic laws when you're driving. And she learned that it wasn't the law to wear your seatbelt in the back seat after age 11. And she also learned that if you didn't have your seatbelt on in the front seat, the police couldn't do anything about it. So I am here today to ask you to upgrade Minnesota's seatbelt law. 2 points: require everyone in a vehicle to wear a seatbelt, regardless of where they sit or how old they are, and allow for enforcement of that law like all other traffic laws in our state. It is a matter simply of life and death. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cooper. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for coming down tonight. Is Mr. Corrigan in the room? Okay, the next person on my list is Assistant Commissioner Holston for the ATV gas tax.
Madam Chair, can I ask the Department of Public Safety someone to come up first in regards to the seatbelt?
Certainly. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Catherine Burkmore. I'm the Deputy Director of the Office of Traffic Safety with the Department of Public Safety. I'd like to preface any comments or questions answered by saying that Kathy Swanson, our director, had hoped to be here tonight and just couldn't make it quite this late, so I'm standing in for her. I'll do the best I can.
And we're thankful that you could. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Burkmore, your department has been trying to coordinate the a little bit of this activity around some of these driver safety issues. Can you tell us where the governor is on primary seatbelt, the GDL, or the GDL, and then the booster seat?
I'm going to look.
Looks like she's going to phone a friend. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Wiggins.
Madam Chair, Member Scott Wiggins, Director of Government Relations at the Department of Public Safety. With regard to booster seat and graduated driver's license, I haven't had specific conversations with the governor's office on those two issues. I don't know where they stand. With regard to primary seatbelt, the governor has said that if primary seatbelt were to make it to his desk, he would sign it.
Senator Murphy.
Madam Chair, then Mr. Wiggins, I take it that the governor supports primary seatbelt. And can you give us an answer on the other two?
I certainly will check on that.
All right.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And if the committee would just have a little patience here for a second. I know that the House voted overwhelmingly to kill most of these provisions, the GDL, the seatbelt bill. Booster seats. Members, I can't understand why that is. Every day we pick up the paper and we see things like this. Three more kids killed. Three more kids that if they would have been buckled up, chances are they would have been injured, but probably not killed. On the very next side of the paper, here you got a DWI guy that, pardon me, I'm getting a little older here. So, teen critically injured when they were run into by somebody that was drunk and driving. Bottom line was is that the person wasn't wearing a seatbelt. If they would have been wearing a seatbelt, the injuries probably would have been quite a bit less. The person was critically injured. We've heard testimony every year in the Senate, especially on the seatbelt bill. And I can't tell you how many families like Ms. Cooper's have come in front of our committee and begged us, not for their family, but for their neighbors and the people that live down the street, for those kids. This isn't that hard. And I would have to say that nobody's going to lose an election over this. 70-some percent of the people, is that right, Ms. Burkmore, 76%?
In a Ms. 2000, Madam Chair, members of the committee, in 2005, a survey of the Minnesotans showed that 71% of Minnesotans support primary enforcement of seatbelt law.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. 71% support a mandatory seatbelt law. 84% of the people already buckle up. Every state that has initiated this has seen right around a 10% increase. If we would increase our compliance rate to that 93 or 94% level, that means 40 to 60 lives that we'll save every year. Now, members, I've said it more than once on the Senate floor that I would give away my election certificate to pass this bill. I'm willing to do that. I would hope that the House members think that saving 40 to 60 lives every year is more important than their election certificate. This is the most important piece for me in this bill. It's the only piece that I think is going to actually save lives in Minnesota. It's the only thing that is in this bill, these three provisions, that is actually going to change the way that ambulance drivers like Representative Powell have to show up at the scene of a crime or at the scene of an accident. This is the only thing that we're going to do to change what happens on our highways. The carnage is not stopping. 500 people on average die every year on our roads. It's a leading cause of death for most young people. People between the ages of 1 and, I believe it's 33. Now, we've all been hammered with these statistics before. I would ask that the House go back and convince leadership, convince the person that sits to your right and to your left, that this is the right thing to do. And you know what? If we all did it, nobody's going to lose an election because we all did it on a bipartisan basis. We voted to save lives. Let's just do it.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. The next item on our list is Tim Werke for Minnesota for Better Roads and Transit relative to the MVEST split. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, good evening. For the record, my name is Tim Werke, and I'm here this evening on behalf of the Coalition Minnesotans for Better Roads and Transit. I also represent the Associated General Contractors as the Highway Division Manager. My purpose here this evening is to go through a few items with respect to the constitutional amendment relative to the motor vehicle sales tax and to point out where our coalition is at with respect to the constitutional amendment provisions in the bill in front of you. I think you all have had distributed a letter that our coalition prepared this afternoon. It should be in front of you. If not, please let me know and we'll have it distributed. In way of short review for you all, Minnesotans for Better Roads and Transit is a broad-based coalition that came together after the passage of the constitutional amendment, I think, if my memory doesn't fail me, a year ago today, upon the veto of the transportation bill, 1 year ago today. And we are an organization now that has grown to more than 700 businesses and organizations that have come together for the purpose of passing this amendment in order to get new revenues, stable sources of funds into our transportation system. And I say transportation system because that's important to this discussion. We are not about highways, we're not about transit, we're about improving the transportation system, which is our goal and our united goal, and we remain united before you this evening behind our position. The bill, as it differs from both bodies, I'd like to point out some things that we would like to testify tonight in support of. There are several provisions that are common in some that are not in both bills that we do support.
Excuse me, members, it starts on R9 and the side-by-side. Mr. Werke.
Madam Chair, thank you. And committee members, on page R9, I believe, is the language that creates the Greater Minnesota Transit account and the Metropolitan Area Transit account, if I'm not mistaken. Excuse me. That may be the provision earlier in the bill. R6, if I could draw your attention to that. We are in support of that provision, which is common to both bills, which would be necessary to allow for the disbursement of the funds when this passes. On page R9 and succeeding pages, obviously we do support and are unified behind the provision that would place this amendment in rank order number 1 on the ballot should multiple or other constitutional amendments passed the legislature this year. We believe that that's important, and we solidly support that provision. Our second provision that we are in support of is the ballot question language, and that is the House provision. And I believe that provision I'm not sure where that is in the.
It's on the bottom of our 10.
A few comments with respect to the ballot question. I'm sure you have heard or you are aware, and if not, I'll clarify. We believe that the House language with respect to the ballot question is preferable for the following reasons. Our coalition has raised substantial dollars already in pursuit of successful enactment of this provision, of this constitutional amendment. And we've done some significant market research, and that market research has shown us that a improved and more clear and more simple defined ballot question positions this amendment in a better light with the voters and a more understandable light with the voters to secure its passage versus the existing ballot question language that in our opinion is already on the ballot and ready for the voters. So from our perspective, we would like to have the ballot question clarified because we think it positions this amendment in a much more favorable light in order to get it passed. With that, I'd like to enter into a brief discussion about the relative distribution of the funds, I think, which is the key crux of the positions amongst the groups that are dealing with this issue. Although the language is common in both bills regarding the 60-40 split as it relates to putting that language into the Constitution, we're very concerned and we remain very concerned as a coalition about changing that constitutional question because of what we feel is a solid opinion from the Attorney General with respect to putting changing the constitutional amendment on behalf of this body, that there would then be potentially two competing constitutional amendments or two similar amendments on the ballot, which we think would serve to confuse the voters even further, or likewise the possibility that there would be litigation involving this issue. Again, citing our goal and our mission as a coalition to do whatever is necessary to see that this issue is successful when it comes before the voters in November. So we're very concerned about that position. We understand and realize that it is identical language in both bills, but I'm here tonight again to register our concern as a significantly large, broad-based coalition that we believe that poses a significant risk to this successful passage in November. Beyond that, Madam Chair, I believe I don't have more significant comments, but if there are questions, I'm sure there will be. I'd be glad to take them on behalf of the coalition.
Thank you, Mr. Werke. I do have a question. On Tuesday morning, a senior member of your organization approached me and stated that if the Abrams language was not adopted on the House floor on Tuesday in the House, the members of your group were going to sue. Can you speak to that?
Madam Chair, specifically, let me address it from this perspective. We're a broad coalition, and that coalition on both ends consists of groups as divergent as the Sierra Club and the groups that I represent, highway contractors, that have not sat in unified positions on very often. And we are united behind this, and that is relative to the way that the language as it sits on the ballot today is distributed. I represent highway contractor interests, obviously, and we have a very strong position in support of the ballot question as, or the ballot language as it currently is, given the fact that there may be exposure although we believe it very small, that transit interests may be served better by the wording of the amendment than highway interests. But we believe we need to come together to get something done in a positive manner rather than to argue about potential scenarios that may or may not come true and find out in November that we have spent a significant amount of time arguing about nothing because it hasn't passed. With respect to your specific question, within our coalition, there are divergent opinions with respect to that. It may very well play out that that is a scenario that may happen. I can't speak to the motivation of who those folks would be or who they are as to whether or not they would follow through with that, but we remain united behind where we're at in this coalition and believe that we're stronger together than we are competing with each other as we have been want to do in the past. So that expression of fracture within our coalition is probably something that is not inaccurate, may occur, but I think there would also be some other possibilities of other groups out there that don't agree with the way the amendment is currently worded that may also litigate this as well. Again, our goal is to try to pass this and get it passed in November, and we think that a united front is the best way to do that.
And is that the case no matter what the legislature adopts?
As I sit before you tonight, Madam Chair, committee members, we have to assess where we are at. If this body chooses to go in a different direction, it means different things for all of us. And we have to then sit down and determine what is best and where we may be headed individually and collectively. And whether that means litigation by a particular party or whether that means we all hang together, I can't answer that tonight. I'm not sure where that's going to go.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Werfel? All right, seeing none, thank you for your time this
evening.
Thank you. The next person I have on my list is Leslie Davis, who would like to speak to the governor's bonding proposal. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Leslie Davis, a Minneapolis resident.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Minnesotans are all interested in state-of-the-art roads, and we're all entitled to them, and this doesn't get it for us. I listed five things that are wrong, and I'll go over this little handout. It'll just take me about 2 or 3 minutes to do the whole thing.
Great, thank you.
What this particular legislation does, it increases the public debt, and we can't afford any more debt. It requires the public to pay $1 billion more in interest, and interest is killing Minnesota and America. We can't continue to pay more interest on more stuff. It takes money from future needs. It partially does some of the road work that needs doing, and it fails to provide road and bridge repairs and maintenance. I don't argue anything about weight limits and seat belts and stuff like that. I'm strictly talking about dollars and cents. The way to correctly fund roads and bridges and maintenance and transit for the future is to exempt state banks from reserve requirements and require them to fund without debt or interest road, bridge, and transit construction projects and repair and maintenance projects. They'll be required to do that, and they'll be exempt from reserve requirements. And these projects that they will fund will have been legislatively approved and assigned a project number by the Minnesota Department of Transportation, all nice and clean and prioritized. Let me give an example how it works. The legislature develops a project list, which you pretty much have, a wish list, 3562, 694, 1460, 49, whichever they are, and MnDOT then assigns them a project number. A state bank or banks in alphabetical order are assigned to each project. Maybe a couple of banks would have to be assigned to the project, depending on the size of it. And that number, that project number, is used as the asset to the bank in order to balance their books. So they give out the money for the project, the asset number balances their books. Just like your car or your house guarantees the loan, the asset number would offset the loan from the bank or the funding from the bank. So here's an example. 3562 Crosstown is project number one. The McCross and Company, road builder, for an example, is hypothetical. Say they win the bid to build project one. And the Bloomington Bank, hypothetically, is assigned and they're the selected funder of this project. McCrossin does the work, submits an invoice to MnDOT for payment. MnDOT examines the invoice and examines the work that was done, and they approve the invoice. And then they advise the Bloomington Bank to simply electronically transfer the funds to MnDOT for payment to McCrossin. So Bloomington Bank already has the project number as their asset. They've already been assigned by law, passed by the legislature, maybe an amendment to this omnibus bill. They've been required by law to fund approved, legislatively approved, and a project-numbered transportation project. And it just moves ahead. And we'll have state-of-the-art roads and bridges and funding and maintenance way on into the future. And the most important thing is that we'll bring debt-free money into circulation. Today, the only way money can come into circulation is through a loan. There's no other way money comes into circulation, whether it's your paycheck from the state or your paycheck at work or from your business. Every dollar that comes into circulation is the result of a loan. This way, money will come into circulation that's funded. There's no interest required to it, and we can begin to capture some of these problems that we're facing with our debt. And that's my story. We are going in the wrong direction by borrowing more money to build roads and bridges and encumbering us with more debt and more interest that we can't afford. So that's my pitch.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we appreciate your time this evening. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to testify on any element of the bill? Seeing none, Senator Murphy, would you like to let the group know what your plans are for tomorrow?
Tomorrow, 9 o'clock, room 107, Capitol.
All right. Thank you. You guys have a good evening, and the meeting's
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. At that time, the Senate will make an offer to the House that will be substantial and include many of the provisions in this bill, both on the House side and Senate side, and other related issues that were kicked to our committee about an hour ago.
Well, I'm sure the House looks forward to that experience. Meeting's adjourned.